This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
A group of scientists warn we're heading into a ghastly future. Not in the next year or two, that is the pandemic stage, but in this decade and the next. The climate crisis and the extinction crisis are already arriving. From Australia, we talk with the lead author, Dr. Corey Bradshaw, director of the Global Ecology Laboratory. But can you handle a little better climate news? Are you ready for any sort of relief? If you worry about a giant methane bomb rising out of Arctic seas, Canadian scientist Andrew McDougall says, let that go. As an expert in permafrost emissions, they will come slowly over thousands of years rather than in a rush, he says. I will follow up next week with new science based directly on subsea methane in the Siberian Arctic. McDougall led new research finding Earth may not keep on warming for centuries once humans reach net zero emissions. Most of us thought it would. The IPCC said it would. Where you stop is where you stay, McDougall tells us. I find that hard to believe. So, I will pepper Andrew with every objection I can think of. At least we have a possibility that Earth may not warm 4 degrees C or more if, and it's always if, we can transition away from fossil fuel emissions, say, in the next decade. That passes for good news these days here on Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
How bad is it? Even scientists can't grasp the reality of what is happening on this planet. Trying to figure out where we are, where we really are, 17 expert scientists pored through over 150 essential papers. Their summary, published January 13th, is called Underestimating the Challenges of Avoiding a Ghastly Future. That seems pretty clear. The lead author, Professor Corey Bradshaw, is the Matthew Flinders Fellow in Global Ecology at Flinders University in Australia. From Adelaide, Corey, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
We can't see this COVID-19 virus, but it has trashed our economies and our personal lives anyway. And we can't see into the future of the environment either. But almost 2 years ago, you and I talked about the rules of extinction. What got you going on this new paper with the Ehrlichs and a whole crew of other great scientists?
That's an interesting story. We had started chatting about this probably over 2 years ago. The idea that we all agree that things are bad. We all agree that we're having trouble giving that message to basically the greater public. But also there seems to be quite a few of our colleagues who, probably because of their individual specializations and the fact that they're all terribly busy, can't quite grasp all of the connecting parts in this complex adaptive system that really work to create a kind of perfect storm of circumstances that we say in the paper will lead to a ghastly future. So we really wanted to hit a few things on the head simultaneously. One of them was, you know, it's beyond just the biodiversity loss. There's a lot of other components in the system that we need to take into account. That single solutions, there's no silver bullet. We've talked about that before. And that the prognosis is pretty dire because none of the signs are pointing in the right direction. And we just wanted to sort of lay our cards on the table and say exactly what was going on and not try to gloss over any of the challenges.
Well, I do talk with a lot of scientists on the show, and one may tell us coral is dying, another talks about disappearing insects, as you say. And I wonder, well, where are the scientists who are tallying this all up and getting the big picture? I thought the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change would do that, but they've been really, really conservative and careful about what they say, and I'm not sure that I trust their results in total.
Well, I mean, you can trust the IPCC insofar as they are mandated to make all of their uncertainties up front, but we've actually published work last year that shows that these uncertainty statements actually accumulate throughout the document and overestimate the uncertainty for particular phenomena that are very well established scientifically. So because of this conservatism in getting all the signatories on board, the language of the IPCC, and to a certain extent probably the IPBES, which is the Inter-Policy Platform for Ecosystem Services and Biodiversity, or Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, similar concept, they tend to inflate the uncertainty because of this political sensitivity.
Well, I know that scientists do have difficulty translating technical work to the media, and the media has their own agenda and bills to pay, and the listeners will have belief buffers, we could call them. Corey, is it possible we've arrived at a threat that can't be communicated properly?
Well, as we state in the paper, the idea that environmentalism in general has become associated with a particular political ideology and has been weaponized by certain other ideologies against largely, you know, left-leaning or progressive politics, despite the fact that environmental degradation affects us all equally. Well, I'll qualify that. If you have a lot of money and you live in a place where there is some semblance of government regulation and you can isolate yourself from some of the more imminent effects, you will be somewhat immune to the effects of an environmental cascade that the poorer or more exposed population will not. So if we always say, too, that, you know, because of this weaponization of environmentalism, that it has become associated with not just the politics, but also the policy implementation. So even if it tends to benefit everyone, it's viewed as simply a political preoccupation as opposed to a way to promote self-sustainability. And that applies across the board. I always argue that the true libertarian, so the one who shuns all forms of government and tax and wants to be left alone and not mandated in any way, so the ultra-conservative libertarian, if they were logical about their points of view politically, they would become some of the strongest environmental advocates, because whatever their neighbors do to their properties will affect them environmentally. So, for example, let's say I own some property and my neighbor poisons her river, and that river flows through my property. I'm therefore going to be affected negatively by it. So if I don't want any interaction or interventions from other people or effects from my neighbors, I should be strongly supporting environmental legislation. But it's in fact quite the opposite because of this weaponization.
Yeah, do you think, I mean, climate is finally reaching the top of the agenda in some countries, perhaps not in yours, but do you think that this climate concern has hidden some of the things that you specialize in, the ongoing loss of living things here on Earth?
Yeah, well, again, as conservation biologists, we consider all of the threats simultaneously, and climate change is one of many. So up till now, most of the extinctions that have happened have been because of habitat loss. And most of that habitat loss has been because of agricultural expansion to feed our population. And that's slowing down some areas, and it's speeding up in others. And it's also a question of death by a thousand cuts, because even if you have a government that comes in and puts in a good policy, not only is it impossible to reclaim the losses that have happened since the previous administration, unless you've got, you know, massive restoration in place, but the next policies that come along that change that, for example, anti-clearing laws and allow people to develop and knock down trees and destroy habitats, you know, even if you come back to a more preservationist policy afterwards, you've already done the damage. It can take, you know, 300 to 1,000 years for a forest to get back its original ecological functions, including everything from water storage, carbon storage, soil health, and the infrastructure available for all the different species that live there. So even if you have changed your government like you have just done, like the Americans have just done in their country, the damage has been done in a lot of cases. And so every time we move forward politically, we've already taken two steps back for every step forward.
And I know that your paper reviews the known state of corals and wetlands and biodiversity and mammals and plants and insects and more. Can it all decline at once, Corey? And then what replaces the vacuum?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Something that's, in fact, we've got some research coming out shortly that talks about this, and some of the work that I discussed with you last time we spoke about extinction cascades. So the fact that we are the primary extinctions, so those extinctions that happen because of direct perturbations, for example, cutting down a forest, they're only really the tip of the iceberg, because all the other species that depend on them also decline and will go extinct. In fact, this concept called co-extinctions might account for most of the extinctions happening in a mass extinction event. Now, what is a mass extinction event? As we explained in the paper, that geologically that's considered to be something above 75% species loss within about 3 million years. Now, about 3 million years is a long time from our perspective, but it's a geological heartbeat. Will we get into the scenario of that kind of loss? Probably. Will it be well within 3 million years? Yes, perhaps even substantially faster than that. But even if, say, even up to 90% of all life collapses on the planet, including us, will the planet be in trouble? No, in the long term, of course not. It will come back. New species will originate. There will be a lag time, perhaps 2, 3, 10 million years thereafter to recover. But there will be a recovery. What we're really talking about here isn't planetary. You're not worried about the planet per se, at least on the geological timeframes. You know, from the perspective of Earth, the only thing that really threatens life is the explosion of our sun, which probably won't happen for several billions of years. So the planet's fine. It's our human society that's in trouble. And that's what we're really talking about. And the ghastly future we're talking about is the ghastly future our children and their children will experience, and their lifestyles and their standards of living will decline as a result.
Your co-author Paul Ehrlich, also a guest on this program at one point, made his name in the late 1960s with the book The Population Bomb, and that was written with Ann Ehrlich. In 1970, the population was half the current 7.8 billion humans on this planet. Why has population somehow dropped out of climate activism and other environmental work?
Well, I think partially because population has been seen largely as a preoccupation of wealthy Western societies that are dictating terms to developing nations. And so it's become a little bit politically incorrect to talk about. It's starting to come back into the conversation because no matter what your perspective, there's no denying that the number of people is and consumption, the co-concepts that can't be separated. But those two things together are responsible for pretty much all of the problems we're seeing today. And as we outlined in the paper, not just for biodiversity, but for general standard of living and the probability of dying horribly. So population is something that has to be addressed, but it can be done in politically sensitive ways. Now, there was work that came out about 3-4 years ago showing that, you know, at least in Western societies, that for all the personal decisions you can make regarding diminishing your footprint, by far and away, by an order of magnitude or more, the best thing you can choose to do is not to reproduce. Now, you can avoid overseas flights, you can eat, you can become a vegetarian, you can buy an electric car, but nothing comes close to not reproducing, simply because of the accumulating effect of adding individuals that consume into the population. Are we going to see a massive population drop in the near future in time to see any decline really in the overall consumption rates? No, that will probably take centuries, not decades, to achieve. Can we lessen the effect that more people will have on the planet and all the negative corollaries of that? Yes, we can, but it doesn't mean that we're going to avoid some form of a ghastly future. I like to tell people that what gets me out of bed in the morning isn't so much that I'm going to try to stop catastrophe. I'm just going to try to make it just a little bit less.
I may have to bleep out that word. All right. I see that politicians watch their next election. Dictators watch their backs. Big lobby money flows in like water. I wonder, can our form of government actually respond to the real implications that you found evidence for on a dozen deadly fronts? What do you think?
You know, apart from a complete restructure of the economic system that currently exists in most countries, which isn't going to happen overnight, being labeled a lefto pinky commie bastard is something that I've received several times. But really, what probably some of the easiest changes we can make to our socio-political systems are achievable with the stroke of a pen, and that really is making political donations illegal. Now, I'm not naive enough to think that that could be done as simply as that. There's a lot of ins and outs that it's a bit beyond my pay grade, really, because I'm not a political scientist. However, it's a fairly straightforward fix. If you can divorce the money from the decision-making, then you're going to end up making democratic decisions that benefit more people and not simply corporations. That is the number one thing we can do as voting public, and pressure our political parties and power to do that. Now, there's obvious reticence to do that because no one likes to stop an income source, and a political party is no different. But we must demand this because any political decision making that is dependent on who pays the most money and therefore has the most influence, you don't have a democracy, you have a plutocracy. In fact, I would argue that there isn't a single country on the planet that has a true democracy. We are all shades of plutocracy. Now, that's doable. And capitalism could persist in that system, not exactly like it is today, but it wouldn't be a complete overhaul. The next thing I think that would need to be addressed, and this is a little bit more extreme, but I personally think that the worst human invention ever made was incorporation and the public listing of companies, because it takes all decision-making and divorces it from human morality entirely, because the board's primary objective, and only objective really, is profit maximization for the shareholders. When you do that, you avoid any sort of moral or, I guess, societal benefit decision-making at the complete expense of every aspect of human decision-making for profit maximization. Now, that's not a popular opinion. But if we could somehow get rid of or at least vastly reduce the stock market and how people invest, then we might have a little bit more of a chance of reducing how ghastly the future might be.
It's shocking to hear you talk like this. I mean, can scientists talk about this kind of thing? I thought your role was to calculate some evidence and publish it and stand back.
Well, that clearly hasn't worked, has it? I mean, scientists are getting more bolder all the time and saying, look, we're at the forefront here, and to use a really terrible pun, the coalface, that we see what's happening in front of us. And it can be a rather depressing job. I liken it to being a paramedic who sees death and destruction every day and then takes that home with them and then suffers PTSD as a result. A lot of my colleagues suffer depression as a result of this. So you feel impotent and you need to do something beyond simply reporting the demise of society and the planet. What we have done, therefore, is expanded into other elements of the complex adaptive system that is human society and looked for empirical evidence of how things are related and, more importantly, how one could intervene to change those. That requires an excellent understanding of human psychology, political science, and human behavior. Those are not my specialties. However, I am certainly starting to work with one of these specialists to see if we can come to some sort of multidisciplinary approach to solving some of these very wicked problems.
Yes, I would love to see psychology brought into this and communications. I wish psychology were a little more advanced than it is. We don't really have a grasp of how our minds work, but we have some clues. Certainly advertisers use what they know against us. Perhaps we could use that to communicate what the future really looks like and how we can soften it, at least, as you say.
Yeah, and that I think that's the key. I mean, a lot of my colleagues in pure sciences, biological sciences, will fully admit that the science is done. You know, we can get more precise estimates. We can always find small successes here and there. But generally speaking, we know what needs to be done. It's about how we do it now. And that is a question for the social and economic sciences. It's not a question of science per se, because we're dealing with human societies.
I note that Anne and Paul Ehrlich have been saying one thing for years: educate women and give them more power. What does that have to do with saving coral or slashing CO2 emissions?
Well, that's actually a fairly straightforward one. Much of the female population on the planet is living within an institutionalized patriarchy and therefore sexism that basically makes the decisions from the perspective of the male involved in the relationship. Now, if women do not have control of their own reproduction or their own finances, then they're at the mercy of someone else's perspective. And if women were empowered to the extent that is possible, and we know it's possible because it's happened in many countries, then we would see fertility rates drop markedly in many countries where they're sort of at the highest possible level, for example, places like Nigeria. The empowerment of women also includes not just reproductive control, but also economic independence. And it's been well established that supplying finances and freeing up the economic situation of women leads to better investment choices that are more sustainable in the long run. I mean, there's an old, it's not really a joke because it's not funny, but it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek way of expressing that if you give money to people that are living in poverty, that much of the money, if you give it to the man, will go towards prostitution and drinking, whereas if you give it to the woman, it will go to feeding her children. Now, we know what's better for the planet. Some other work we have coming out soon shows that the number one determinant of reduction in fertility across countries is reducing child mortality. So clearly, anything that promotes child survival is also going to reduce fertility and therefore get a little bit more on top of the population issues.
Now, all this sounds pretty awful for other people somewhere else, but I don't believe it will hit me directly, and that's the kind of inbuilt optimism built into most of us humans. What do you think, from your in-depth review of science, should we expect things to get better?
Well, I think the pandemic is a perfect example of how environmental destruction can affect all of us. And it has, as you said in the beginning of the interview, it's crippled economies and killed millions of people. And we're not out of the whirlpool yet. We have somewhere to even with a vaccine. The problem is making that link to the environmental degradation that is ultimately the cause of these viruses shifting over from animals to humans. We've been warning humanity about pandemics for decades, and some of them have happened already. This is probably the best example of that. Will they happen again? Of course they will. Will they happen more frequently? Most likely. Will they be as virulent? We're unsure of that component. But when you see economies on their knees and people dying in droves and mass graves, you really have to be thick not to make the link to our environmental predicament. Now, it's also things like natural disasters, which are a little bit more in your face. In Australia, last year, we had the worst bushfires in our history. And, it was a real turning point in Australian politics. But then the pandemic came along and we sort of forgot about that. But bushfires are only going to get worse and worse. Bushfires in California, bushfires in the Amazon, bushfires in Russia. Those are just some of the things. We haven't even mentioned cyclones. We haven't mentioned sea level rise. But all of these things are making life worse for people. And just talk to the insurance industry. They've been on top of this stuff for decades because of money's involved.
Whenever a public figure is arrested, even for a heinous crime, it seems to me, the news media usually runs a nice bio photo with the story, a suit and tie, rather than their mugshot disheveled. And I hear you warning scientists may be doing the same thing. What are you calling for in the science community?
Well, I think generally in the science community, what our main message here is that no one discipline, no one expert or at least one solution is going to fix the problem. We have to realize that we are within this complex system and we have to work beyond our comfort zone. And we also can't avoid imparting some sense of doom and gloom in our work, even if that there is the danger of turning people off. Because, at the end of the day, a lot of people just sort of say, look, I don't want to hear about the bad news anymore. I'll just have a glass of wine and forget about it all. But unless we're absolutely clear about the magnitude of the challenge, all of our efforts will come to very little, and we will unfortunately miss the boat. And that's what we're concerned about.
By the time a science article is reviewed and published, you're already working on something else, I'm sure. What is on your agenda, Corey Bradshaw?
Well, the next step, obviously this laid bare quite a few problems and didn't offer a lot of solutions, because the solutions, for one, we didn't really have the space to talk about solutions, but two, the solutions are very complex in their own right and extensive. So our next steps are to try to do exactly what we were just discussing earlier about amassing experts within these particular fields that understand more about human behavior and society, and try to put together a very prescriptive, applied approaches to fixing systems and doing the easy stuff first. Because if there is a pathway and it's empirically supported, then there's a higher likelihood of uptake at the political level. We can't force politicians to do that because they're beholden to their constituencies. However, if we provide not quite so vague recommendations, we give them an actual recipe or a roadmap for how to do these things, then we might get a little bit more traction. So that's certainly the next step.
As we wrap this up, Corey, is there anything else you would like to say to our listeners, like maybe a lifeline in the storm?
Well, I said earlier, the thing that gets me up in the morning is to try to make sure that my daughter's life, while I'm convinced it won't be as rosy as it is now, but it is not quite as ghastly. And, anything we do, any small successes we have should indeed be celebrated. I'm not suggesting for a moment that we should just throw up our hands and say it's all for naught, because it's not. Anything that we do that's positive is good. However, what we need to realize is that if we just continue down the path of, okay, I recycle and I take the bus, that's not going to be enough. So try to do what you can and try to exert your democratic rights to put in some of these vast sweeping changes to policies and political processes that will benefit our future generations, our children. And, anyone who is a parent will know this straight up, that the last thing you want for your child is for them to suffer. And anything we can do to prevent that is a good thing.
We've been speaking with Dr. Corey Bradshaw from Flinders University in Australia. He is the lead author of the paper, Underestimating the Challenges of Avoiding a Ghastly Future, published January 13th. Find links to the paper and a good introductory article in The Conversation in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Corey, I always appreciate talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
How many times have we been told, even if we stop emissions today, Earth will continue warming for hundreds of years? Maybe that is not true. Maybe we can stop global warming in its tracks if we ever get to zero emissions. We investigate all that with the lead author of the study that offers a glint of hope. Dr. Andrew McDougall is the lead author of more than 16 peer-reviewed papers since 2008, which began well before his doctorate. Andrew is assistant professor at the Department of Climate and Environment at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, Canada. From Antigonish, Andrew McDougall, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I have to start with a full disclosure. I read the paper published in BioGeosciences, and that's an open access journal. Anybody can find it. It's provided by the European Geosciences Union. And this paper has 29 authors from all over the world, and some have appeared on this program already. And still, with all that, I am not sure that I believe it. So let's get to work. Andrew, why did you apply for access to so many of the world's top climate models? How would you summarize the results from that 2020 paper?
So there is a fair amount of variability between the different models, but overall, the kind of multi-model mean is a zero change in temperature after emissions cease. So if you drop to emissions to zero, you wait 50 years, on average, the models have zero change in temperature. So basically, where you stop is where you stay. Now, the actual range is more like a cooling of about a third of a degree to about a warming of a third of a degree, and there's kind of lots of intricate details, but they average out to about zero.
So if we get to 3 degrees of warming over pre-industrial by the year 2100, which some scientists are warning is quite possible, this paper suggests that if we finally get our act together by then and there are no more fossil fuel burning and there's no more greenhouse gas emissions coming from humans, we would stay around the 3-degree level?
Roughly. So that also is for about 2 degrees of warming. So one of the things we did look at in the paper was different amounts of cumulative emissions. So there were 3 experiments, one with 750 billion tons, one with 1,000 billion tons, and one with 2,000 billion tons. And those roughly line up to 1.5, 2 degrees, and 3 degrees of warming. When you do go towards the higher end, towards 2,000 billion tons of carbon emitted, the tendency is for the models to have some more warming after emissions cease. So, for example, the UK Met Office model warms about 0.5 degree after about 3-ish degrees of warming. And same with the MUROC, the Japanese model. And then some of them still have a small amount of cooling. But as you go to higher and higher cumulative emissions, this where you stop, where you stay does appear to break down.
Well, that sounds a lot better than going to 4, 5, or 6 degrees, which a lot of people have kind of panicked about. Now, why did the reports from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change repeatedly predict centuries more warming, even if emission controls were successful?
So that's a related concept to zero emissions commitment, which is constant composition commitment. So what the earlier models did, and what they were only really capable of doing, is asking, okay, if we keep CO2 emissions at today's concentration, what will happen? And if you do that, then you do get continued warming for centuries, until the ocean comes into full equilibrium with the changed energy balance, and that takes a really long time. And so basically what's changed is we've changed the question to what if emissions go to zero? And then it's a question of, okay, what happens to the sinks? So right now there's the two big sinks, the land carbon uptake and the ocean carbon uptake, and will these continue after emissions sink, or will they switch from a sink to a source? So the land is still extremely uncertain and complicated, but all of the models universally agree that the ocean will continue to take up carbon after emissions go to zero, which makes sense because it's still taking up heat, and the two processes are very closely linked.
Okay, I want to get to that in more detail in just a minute, but first, I'm just wondering how realistic the idea of zero emissions is. I mean, if a large part of our emissions comes from agriculture, and we expect to feed billions more people, and we're really not on any sort of track towards zero emissions at the moment, do you think it is possible at all? I mean, are we studying something that is kind of a thought experiment, or are we looking at real goals that governments have to take into account?
That is a very good point with the agriculture. So on the fossil fuel side, certainly I'm not terribly old, I'm 34, but in the kind of time I've been aware of these in the last, since I was in my mid-teens, the news has gotten better on the technology side in terms of, all right, can we get fossil fuel emissions down to zero? The agricultural emissions are more complicated, but the thing with the zero emissions commitment is we're really looking at CO2. And the other greenhouse gases, methane and N2O from agriculture predominantly, are quite different. And so with these shorter-lived gases, the warming you get depends more on the rate of emissions. So because a methane molecule only exists for about 10 years in the atmosphere before it reacts into CO2 and water, it's really the rate of emissions that counts. So the amount of warming you get from agriculture basically comes down to how many, you know, rice paddies and cows you have, and of course the N2O flux from the nitrogen fertilizers. So if you stabilize those emissions, you would stabilize the warming from agriculture, assuming you don't cut down a bunch of forests and turn them into agricultural land, which is what is happening in, you know, the Amazon.
So one possible objection concerns, as one 2020 paper put it, self-sustained melting of permafrost, even if all man-made greenhouse gas emissions stop in 2020. And that was based on a study published in Nature by Jorgen Randers and Ulrich Goluk. And Penn State's Michael Mann was one of several scientists who discounted that work. Andrew McDougall, I know you got your doctorate with a paper on permafrost thaw. Will it continue even if we rein in our emissions?
Yes. So if emissions go to zero and temperature does roughly stabilize, permafrost will continue to thaw and the organic matter that's in that permafrost will continue to decay and release carbon to the atmosphere. So if we look at kind of the lower end emission scenarios, we're talking about probably about order of 50 billion tons of carbon released in the 21st century, and then more thereafter. And this does play into the zero emissions commitment work, because only one of the models that participated in the study accounted for permafrost carbon, which was the model I helped develop in my PhD. But the permafrost feedback is big, but it's slow. So it's more like a glacier than a forest. So you hit it, and it begins to respond, and then it's kind of slowly leaching carbon out of these soils for hundreds and thousands of years. But at a rate that's on the kind of order of half a billion tons to a billion tons of emissions, which is roughly similar to kind of modern land use change emissions. So only about 10% at maximum of our current fossil fuel emissions.
Well, that matches what I'm finding from another paper published in Environmental Research Letters, and it's about subsea permafrost carbon stocks and an expert assessment of how fast they will come out. But there is a whole crew of people who are concerned about methane coming out of Siberia from the Siberian shelf under the sea, that it might leak into the atmosphere for centuries. What is your assessment of the Arctic methane threat from under the sea?
So that's one of the big questions, and probably the most vulnerable of the kind of methane pools in the Arctic, is this subsea permafrost. So for those who know a bit about permafrost but not about this, it's a little bit confusing, but basically in the last glacial maximum, there is this area that had a lot of permafrost, and then it got flooded when the glaciers melted and sea levels rose. So you have this part of the Arctic shelf off the coast of Russia that has permafrost below the ocean. And the reason it continues to exist is because the seawater is actually below freezing. Because seawater is salty, it freezes slightly below 0 degrees Celsius. Because the permafrost is fresh water, it melts at zero. Kind of modern warming and the removal of sea ice, that ocean is warming up, that permafrost has begun to thaw, and there does appear to be some observational evidence that methane is coming out of that. Now, the thing is, it's hard to make methane come out really fast and everywhere at once. So this idea that there's going to be like a big, large plume of methane coming out doesn't really make sense. But you could have a long leak of it, and then it's a matter of, okay, how much of this will get into the atmosphere? Because there's this whole class of microorganisms called methanotrophs that actually eat methane, and some of them live in the ocean. And much of that methane might never make it into the atmosphere. So it's a complicated problem involving subsea permafrost, the geology, and then the oceanography, and then the biological oceanography. So it's definitely a problem that people are going to have to work on for a long time, but I don't think there's any plausible way to get enough methane out of there that would equal like our current fossil fuel methane output.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Canadian scientist Andrew McDougall, and he led a study showing Earth may not keep on warming if we can get our emissions totally under control. Let's talk about the timing assumed in the models that you ran. When did the period of zero emissions start? And then you looked at what might happen 50 years after that?
So the experiment we ran in this wasn't a particularly realistic one. It's what's called the 1% experiment, and this is where CO2 concentration in the atmosphere goes up at 1% a year and then kind of grows exponentially. So this experiment was developed in the 80s when they had really clunky computers for the very first computer models, and it's become this benchmark experiment that every climate model does. And there were a few reasons to pick this experiment. Simple one was we were really late into the IPCC process to try to get this model intercomparison project going. And so all the modeling groups had already done this one, so they could start our experiment from what they'd already done. So it wasn't as much computer resources. But one of the problems with this experiment is you ramp up CO2 much faster than has been the historical observation. So we're cutting emissions off 60, 70 years into this experiment. So certainly in the kind of next generation of this intercomparison project, we want to do kind of more realistic scenarios following the historical trajectory, and also do the non-CO2 greenhouse gases and aerosols as well. But the thing with the kind of cumulative emissions framework and the TCRE work that's been done and the carbon budgets is it really shouldn't matter very much how quickly you emit carbon, only the cumulative total. So we would think that this would be fairly similar to what happened in the more realistic experiments, which does roughly correspond to papers that have done more realistic experiments.
But, Andrew, what happens if we cross one or several of those tipping points that scientists talk about, or we get cascading tipping points, as recently suggested, before nations struggle to the point of zero emissions? perhaps big natural cycles will be irreversible by then, and so how would we ever get to zero emissions?
So the zero emissions we're talking about is fossil fuel emissions. So that's entirely under human control. I mean, obviously it's a huge political project to completely replace all of this infrastructure and reform our society to get to the point where we can get to zero fossil fuel emissions. And then we do have to worry about these natural feedbacks. And, I mean, that's the reason these Earth system models were developed in the first place, was to look at first these carbon cycle feedbacks, and as they grow more realistic and more complex, these other feedbacks. Part of what we're finding is the time scales we look at. And so a lot of these kind of feedbacks that you would expect to cascade into the future and, you know, bring Earth into a warm state like it had been before the present glaciations, that these feedbacks act more on geological timescales than human timescales. So, for example, the feedback I know best, the permafrost carbon feedback, you're talking about a system that's going to release carbon over several thousand years. So it's really slow compared to the current human emissions. And it's similar with glaciers, which I did my master's degree on glaciology, and you hit Antarctica and Greenland with warming, and they're going to keep melting for a really long time. But those changes are so much slower than the modern changes we're causing with fossil fuel emissions that the kind of first priority must be to get the fossil fuel emissions under control. And we'll worry about the rest of that when we get there.
Assuming we get there. So, Dr. James Hansen, formerly a leading scientist at NASA, one of the most famous climate scientists, has been publishing about Earth energy imbalance for years. He suggests there could be up to a degree of warming hidden by air pollution, among other things. And we can measure the imbalance. How does that fit into your findings of a climate that could stabilize itself more or less?
Yes, so there definitely is. So if you remove all the air pollution, you would get a warming effect. So currently, air pollution, mostly sulfates, but a few other nasty gases, have this effect where they brighten clouds and also directly reflect sunlight away, and so they counteract part of the warming. So if you stop emitting those, you would get a warm-up effect, which is sometimes called the aerosol shock. But on the other side, we have these short-lived greenhouse gases that counteract either some of that or more of that. It's quite uncertain how the magnitudes will match up. But if you reduce your methane emissions from fossil fuels, the methane concentration will relatively quickly drop off and counteract at least part of that warming. And then the other one, big one, the black carbon. So you have emissions of literally soot that go into the atmosphere. They land on snow. They make snow darker and have a warming effect. Well, if you get rid of your coal-fired power plants, which make your sulfate emissions, you also get rid of your black carbon. In the past, it's been said that these roughly cancel out, whether it's exactly or just the same kind of order of magnitude, that there will be some cancellation. So if you did a more kind of realistic experiment where all of these different forcings went to zero over time, then you might get some warming or some cooling, depending basically on whether the methane effect is bigger or the aerosol effect is bigger.
Now, studying deep time, we find this planet has been in a hotter state for much longer periods than the Ice Age times where humans appeared. And eminent scientists like Joachim Schellenhuber worry Earth will warm beyond 4 degrees, setting off all kinds of feedback effects. I gather your study doesn't discount the possibility of going into a hothouse Earth. Am I right?
No, but if you enter a hothouse Earth state, it would take a very long time to get there. Those studies, of course, are well supported in that through most of Earth's history, through deep time, Earth has been in a hothouse state. It's one of the kind of two basic stable states, the climate system, where you have either the no ice or all ice. So if you want to move towards, well, we don't want to, but if you were to move towards a hothouse state, you need to remove the ice caps. So you need to get rid of Greenland and Antarctica, which is going to take a long time. And then you're going to have to reconfigure the ocean circulation. So we're not going to have the deep water formation sites in the North Atlantic and along the Antarctic coast anymore. And so that's going to take another few thousand years to rearrange the ocean. These processes take a long time. And then it's also an open kind of question on the geological side of, okay, like what's the ultimate cause of our current colder state over millions of years? Is it the rise of the Himalayas? Is it the mountain building in kind of the Indonesian area? And what sets this kind of balance of CO2 over geological time? But if you're thinking on kind of a human perspective, like 10,000 years out into the future, that these things are going to happen relatively slowly.
Well, that's slightly more hopeful. We can stall off doom for thousands of years. Maybe humans will figure out a solution. So As you mentioned earlier, your study does depend on the land and ocean sinks for soaking up the extra carbon and leveling us off or maybe even cooling us a little bit. But I have to say, I just interviewed Dr. Catherine Duffy from Northern Arizona University, and she led the study titled, How Close Are We to the Temperature Tipping Point of the Terrestrial Biosphere? And essentially, she argued that when we reach the upper limit of land plants, they become a source of carbon in the atmosphere rather than capturing it into a sink. And Susan Natale told us something similar, that the winter Arctic's already producing more greenhouse gases than are being absorbed by plants in the northern summer. So what happens to your models if the land sinks decline and become carbon sources instead?
So that does actually happen in a lot of the models. All of these models have a land component. How realistic they are is, of course, open to question. But they do have different plant function types, which are stimulating the plants, taking up carbon, and the soils, which when you get warmer, soil carbon decays faster, goes back into the atmosphere. And so many of the models in the results of the paper are pretty close to that transition point. And a lot of the variability in whether you get a little bit of cooling or a little bit of warming depends on how strong that residual land sink or transition to a land source is. The part of it that's much more predictable and stable is the prediction of continued uptake by the ocean.
Andrew, you and your team got access to some of the world's biggest climate models, and there's a lot of demand on them. Why is it so important to know the possible results of zero emissions?
The key for zero emissions is trying to get this concept of a carbon budget nailed down. So a finite amount of carbon, fossil fuels that you can burn over all of time and stay below some temperature guardrail. So usually the Paris targets of 1.5 or 2 degrees. And to make this system make sense, you need to know how much warming you'll get if you do go to zero emissions. So if you want to know how much fossil fuels you can burn over all time, you need to account for the warming that would happen in the future if there was any.
I wonder if these model results will help us as kind of a shining goal, a kind of prize we can hope for if we make those wrenching changes to get off fossil fuels. Is that how you see it?
Yes. So when I do public presentations, my kind of three main points I try to kind of tell the general public to update them, you know, kind of what we've learned since An Inconvenient Truth, is that warming is approximately proportional to cumulative emissions of CO2, so total amount of fossil fuels we burn. Where we stop is roughly where we stay. So once you stop burning fossil fuels, you will roughly stay at those temperatures. And then where you stay, you're going to stay for a very long time. So when we take some of these models, the intermediate complexity ones, and run them 10,000 years out into the future, you get very little cooling. Once you reach that plateau, you're kind of stuck there. And even if you were to do negative emissions with technology that doesn't exist and may never exist, once heat gets into the ocean, there's no easy way to get it out. Where you stop is where you stay.
Worth remembering. Andrew McDougall, you have a good record of leading scientific teams and publishing, especially for a relatively young scientist. What are the big questions you would like to tackle?
So, I mean, that's a hard one. Probably should start thinking of it because I need to renew my grants pretty soon.
Well, what are you working on now? Let's put it that way.
So I'm still working on zero emissions commitment work. So we kind of got this stuff done really quickly before the IPCC deadlines, but we haven't really looked at the 3D results yet. So if the model overall averages zero change in temperature, is that true for land versus ocean, tropics, extratropics? So I want to dig deeper into those kind of intricacies. I'm still interested in developing these Earth system models further. So I have one of my PhD students who's adding phosphorus to the kind of climate model I worked on as a PhD student. And so getting more of these biogeochemical cycles to try to get a better realistic representation of the Earth system, the best we can get. Kind of still interested in these broader Earth system questions of, like, if we look into deep time, you know, why are we in this ice house state in the first place? And basically, will there be another ice age in the future, given what we've already done to the Earth system? And so I'm getting more interested in these bigger, longer-term questions, probably the more time I'm in a relatively small university talking to geologists a lot.
Well, I'm going to put links to your work page and your CV in my show blog at ecoshock.org, and I'll toss in links to all the science we've talked about. Is there any other webpage or Twitter feed or something where people can follow your work?
I do have a Twitter handle. I'm not very active. I was pretty reluctant to sign up to Twitter, but it had to be done in the end. So if I do publish papers, I do put my stuff out there.
I will track down your Twitter feed and toss that in my blog as well. We've been talking about the paper, Is There Warming in the Pipeline? A Multi-Model Analysis of the Zero Emissions Commitment from CO2 from St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, Canada. We've been speaking with the lead author, Dr. Andrew McDougall. Andrew, thank you for helping us to understand here on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. Alex here with updates on breaking climate news. You may have heard this planet is losing ice in record amounts at an accelerating rate. Here is the summary from the University of Leeds in the UK, seat of the lead author, Dr. Thomas Slater. Quote, 25 January 2021. Satellite observations are the best method for tracking ice loss because the cryosphere is vast and remote. Using these and some numerical models, the authors show that Earth has lost 28 trillion tons of ice since 1994 from the Arctic sea ice, 7.6 trillion tons, from ice shelves, 6.5 trillion tons, from mountain glaciers, 6.1 trillion tons, from Greenland, 3.8 trillion tons, and Antarctic ice sheets, 2.5 trillion tons, and Antarctic sea ice, 0.9 trillion tons. It has taken just 3.2% of the excess energy Earth has absorbed due to climate warming to cause this ice loss, end quote from the University of Leeds. The paper is indeed called Earth's Ice Imbalance, as published in the EU journal Cryosphere on January 25, 2021. I already covered this record ice loss in my show last September 2020 with the same lead author, Thomas Slater. As I explain in my blog for that show, Thomas Slater from Leeds University reports glacier ice loss has surpassed the worst-case scenarios. Radio EcoShock was there 5 months ahead of the pack. Definitely listen to that interview in our 2020 show archive. That's free. As we heard from our guest, Andrew McDougall, the excess energy absorbed in melting ice is one factor slowing down warming from our emissions. It acts like a kind of cushion, almost hiding our true situation. They call it the Earth-Ice Imbalance. Scientists expect that will take thousands of years to melt all the ice off Greenland and Antarctica. That will make sea levels more than 200 feet higher than today. The redistribution of the mass of ice as it moves from fixed land into the global seas is so great it is affecting Earth's orbit in a tiny way. Changed locations of weight may also add to existing geological stress points. Perhaps that will mean more earthquakes or volcanic eruptions, but we do not know for sure. I covered relationships between climate change and earthquakes in my Radio EcoShock show called Earthquake Time Bombs with UK geohazards expert Dr. Bill McGuire. He's the author of the book Waking the Giants. You can find that at my site, ecoshock.org, by selecting Programs and then Archives for 2016. All past shows are there for you free of charge. No sign-up is required. There is no advertising. Let's talk a little bit about the Earth energy imbalance and the smog and warming. Of course, the ice energy imbalance is just part of this much larger Earth energy imbalance in our changed atmosphere. In late December 2020, I put out a Let's Learn Together video about warming in the pipeline due to that imbalance. The champion warning about it is Dr. James Hansen, retired from NASA. Part of the struggle is to discover how much extra heat is already looming over us but hidden by our pollution. Various types of polluting particles like sulfates in the upper atmosphere reflect incoming energy from the sun back out into space before it arrives on Earth. But that smog is short-lived. As you know, it can be washed out in weeks by the rain. We may be living in a dangerous time, especially as pretty well every country works to clean up air pollution. That kills millions of people every year. Now we have another voice on that scene, cloud researcher Franziska Glashmeyer from Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands may have another bit of good news, if you can stand any more good news. Her paper, Aerosol Cloud Climate Cooling, Overestimated by ShipTrack Data, was published in the journal Science on January 31st, 2021. Well, that doesn't sound very important, but it turns out a lot of calculations about how much energy polluting clouds reflect back into space was based on a study of smog tracks left by shipping. Satellites can see the trails of diesel smoke laying along the major shipping routes, and they studied that. Dr. Glashmeyer and her team, quote, now show that this approach overestimates the cooling effect of aerosol addition by up to 200%. These findings underscore the need to quantify stratocumulus cloud responses to anthropogenic aerosols to understand the climate system, end quote. You can find links to that study in my show blog at ecoshock.org. But what does it mean? Is it possible there is less hidden warming in the pipeline than previously thought? Possible. That means a little less fear, because we can see the current ocean warming, violent storms and wildfires, and they may be closer to our current energy state, with less of a hot punch in the face to hit us if we clean up the air. And we need to clean up that air, because, well, humans need clean air, so do animals and so do plants. Next week, I'm going to try to talk part of the climate community out of a deeply held conviction about climate doom. You know, making a radio show is a little like the American protest singer David Rovix. He is the lefty troubadour. Check out his music at davidrovix.com. Years ago, I recorded one of David's concerts in Vancouver. David can write a song that scorches anything. He told us, basically, I just keep singing until I have alienated everybody. Yeah, that's how it goes. I'm Alex Smith. Join me next week on Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Sometimes you can smell death coming around the corner. You run and you run. And then
run, run, running, 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 run, run, running, running.